Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And also, we've got a special guest. His name is Ryan Richards. He's from the Colorado School of Mines up in Golden, Colorado. And this gentleman is a material scientist. Basically, he likes to make inorganic materials that are good catalysts. And I think you all know catalysts speed things up. They do things we would like as opposed to things we don't want. So, Ryan, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's going to be a lot of fun. But before we get on to inorganic materials, why they're important, maybe even into batteries, because I know you're into batteries in a big way, why are you a scientist? How on earth did you become what you are today?
I don't know if there was ever really a conscious decision. I never remember wanting to be an actor or a musician or any of these sorts of things. I sort of went through life, went to Michigan State for undergraduate with the original intention of becoming a veterinarian. And
there was another plan A at the beginning.
Well, and so in that pre-veterinary curriculum, there was a requirement that you do an internship with a veterinarian. And I was very idealistic at the time, and I thought, you know, I would be out saving all of these animals and doing these wonderful things. And it turns out that what veterinarians spend most of their time doing is dealing with owners. And the ones that you spend the most time with and the ones who give you the most money are the really crazy ones. And so I decided that wasn't really my thing, and I had done a lot of chemistry classes, and there was an interesting graduate program in Michigan, at Central Michigan, between Central Michigan and Dow Chemical. So I went up and did that for 2 years. And then I just really fell in love with the sciences and went on and did a PhD and a postdoc and just continued on.
Whereabouts is a PhD?
So I did my PhD at Kansas State University in the Little Apple, Manhattan, Kansas.
Manhattan, Kansas.
Manhattan, Kansas.
Do they call it the Little Apple?
They call it the Little Apple, indeed.
That's cute.
But don't you remember when you were young doing any experiments in your backyard or something like that? Some of our guests have talked about that.
Yeah, but I was always... No, it was always sort of broadly science. So, you know, I had some of these like construction sets for making these little plastic skyscraper systems. And I guess at some point I had a chemistry, you know, one of those little kits.
So you must have been disappointed when you went to Manhattan, Kansas, if you were into skyscrapers and you went to the wrong place.
No, it was a great place. It's a great little college town. I really enjoyed my time there. It was it was a great place to get a lot of stuff done.
What did you do? What was your sort of research area for the PhD?
So when I was doing my PhD, I was working on making initially, we were making nanoparticles for so-called destructive adsorbents, so things that could adsorb toxic chemicals from the air and decompose them into neutral molecules that were environmentally okay.
And still is a holy grail of people in environmental chemistry and environmental science.
And then I don't know what I did, and I guess I never will now, but then 4 years into that program, I was sent to Siberia, and I worked at the Boriskov Institute of Catalysis for half a year doing catalysis with these particles. And then that really sort of generated a love for the phenomena of catalysis in me, and I've sort of been pursuing that ever since.
What struck you most when you went from Middle America, you know, it's still a research lab, and research labs are very similar all around North America. And then you land up in a Siberian research institute. Tell us what was the initial cultural and scientific impact that it had on you.
Well, the first thing I figured out was that minus 40 is the same in Celsius and Fahrenheit. It's where the two scales cross at minus 40, and it's really cold in both. And so, as an American, you have to really, you know, adapt this math in your mind. You know, what is a gram to an ounce, and what is a kilometer to a mile, and all of these measurements.
In the laboratory, they used ounces?
Well, just in life. You know,
in life,
to the grocery
yes.
store, and you know, they ask you how big of a steak do you want, and they don't know.
I had the same issue when I first came here. A can of beer was in 12 ounces. I said, what is all this about? Where are the pints have gone? Right?
Exactly. Culturally, it was a really unique experience. So I was the first Westerner to work at this Institute of Catalysis in more than a decade. And so the people were very embracing, very open. And so 1999, when I went there, was when the ruble had really crashed. So it had gone from being, I think, approximately 6 rubles for one American dollar to 26 in like 2 days.
Wow,
and so
you were being paid in American dollars.
Well, I was being paid as a graduate student, and then they were giving me some stipend there to sort of live off of. But, I mean, it was like $200 a month or something like that.
Anything different about the scientific environment? I mean, did you begin to think, why, this is an interesting way to tackle the problem, or was it just the same as you would have been doing in Kansas?
Well, no. So this was an institute of catalysis. So there's this city, Akademgorodok, which is the academic city there in Novosibirsk, Russia. And they had, I forget what, like 17 institutes of the Russian Academy of Sciences that were all dedicated towards certain things. And it was really sort of an interesting social engineering thing, because everybody you met was sort of a second or a third generation academic whose parents were also in the Russian Academy of Sciences. And so they had been sort of, socially developing this super genius society.
Full of nepotism. You can put it two ways, right?
To a degree. I mean, there were a lot of people there. But the institute approach was new to me from, we have institutes here in the U.S. I just never been exposed to them. But so in this Institute of Catalysis, you had everything was focused around catalysis, but you started at one end of the building with physicists and theoreticians doing computational mathematical models of things all the way through every intermediate step. And then on the back end, you had like British Petroleum was like setting up 20,000 liter reactors on the other end of the
institute.
So it was really everything from
very interdisciplinary.
Very interdisciplinary, you know, like I said, starting with physicists and theoreticians doing mathematical models on one end, and then people making in different steps, different scale-ups, different testing, all the way through to real making stuff on pilot plant scale at the other end of the building,
did
basically.
Did it surprise you that the British Petroleum, you know, a first-class business concern, was over there? I mean, that's slightly surprising to me that far back.
No. There was a pretty international presence there in Novosibirsk at that time. And it's really, if you start looking around, it's surprising that there aren't more catalysis institutes around the world. There's a few here and a few there. But if you look at the field of catalysis, so I give a talk. One of the talks I give is why catalysis is the most important thing in the world. And I give it to some of our freshmen and sophomore students and some of these things. And it's surprising how poorly catalysis is covered in the chemistry or the physics curriculum.
But, at the undergraduate level, you're talking about.
I mean, for the listeners out there, catalysis accounts for somewhere between 35% and 40% of the gross world product. So of every dollar that's generated in the world's economy, 35 to 40 cents of that is from a catalytic process. And then in addition to that, through the Haber process, 35% of the global population is sustained from the fertilizers made from the Haber process.
Well, I was going to bring that. I mean, the Haber process has been going, I don't know how, 100 years or something,
yeah,
like that.
Something like that.
But it hasn't changed much.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
That is one of these things that if it doesn't appear to be broken, don't fix it. Right? So there is a resistance on the part of people who use catalysis on this scale to, in fact, not embrace new technologies. Or is that changing now, I hope?
Well, so to your first point, the Haber process is very energy intensive. You have to get to high pressures, use some different high temperatures there. So it is one of the Department of Energy's grand challenges for the next decade is to come up with new catalysts, new processes for generating ammonia.
Just to let the audience know, what we're talking about is taking nitrogen N2 and transforming it into ammonia, which then can be used for all sorts of wonderful
Fritz Haber
things.
And Fritz Haber, yes.
The question there is that that was developed in Germany, right?
That's right.
And there's a lot of people that say the Germans did that because the British were blockading them in World War I and they had to make their own fuel.
That and gunpowder.
And gunpowder, yes.
So they were getting all of their
So some people blame the World War II on Fritz Haber.
No, and that's exactly right. So they were getting all of their guano from Chile to make the gunpowder, and then the Allies thought that they would just blockade them off from this. They'd run out of gunpowder, and nothing would go anywhere. And then Fritz Haber, really, for the listeners out there, the air that we breathe is 78% nitrogen, and they literally turned air into
gunpowder
and nitrates, which was horrible for World War II.
Well, in fact, you go one stage further and point out that, yes, the blockade that the Allies, if I can call that, in the First World War switched around in the Second World War,
sure.
And the Nazi U-boats were blockading Britain.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, what you reap, you sow in one way or another.
Technology that was developed really for wartime has turned into something that sustains 35% of the world's population now in terms of the fertilizers that come from that.
Well, let me ask you another question about catalysis. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the catalysts that are in every automobile in the world, or at least in the United States?
Yes.
And that was something that was invented by Sam Tauster back at Exxon when I was there.
I mean,
these are the platinum catalysts we're talking about?
Well, let him say a little bit about those catalysts, please.
Yeah, so, I mean, the three-way catalyst in your catalytic converter, so everybody's probably familiar with this technology. And you can really, if you start digging, you can look at pictures of, say, Los Angeles pre-catalytic converter and even some parts of China now, where I think without the invention of the catalytic converter, Los Angeles and most metropolitan areas would probably be uninhabitable now. Just because of the NOx gases coming out of the cars and the sheer number of cars that you have.
Or they could have transformed from having private motor cars to efficient public transport.
Or
there's always
like that
other way that you can predict the future or suggest the future. But I'm sorry, carry on.
So this is a remarkable technology that does multiple reactions in this catalytic converter, and it's able to do this with, so platinum is a relatively rare metal that really is only found in South Africa and Russia, and it's one of the challenges.
But every car in the United States has
used
platinum.
Car lots.
That's exactly right.
Did you ever meet Sam, by the way? Sam Tauster, he was the inventor.
I have not met him, no. But this technology, I mean, you're able to do these catalytic transformations with a catalytic converter that doesn't have so much platinum in it that that people are stealing these things off of your car, right? The loading's relatively low. And it's able to do this all the way from Alaska at minus 40 degrees all the way down to Tierra del Fuego and everything in between. I mean, that's wide
a
temperature
efficient
range.
Right.
And it can do that from startup to finish.
We're going to take a break here. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Kinelli, and our guest today is Ryan Richards from the Colorado School of Mines, talking about catalysis. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. Genetic therapies present exciting possibilities, and one place that's now leading with the cutting-edge experiments is China.
Today, only 10 human clinical trials in the world use a technology called CRISPR, which makes gene editing possible, and 9 of those trials are in China.
CRISPR is short for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. In bacteria, where CRISPR was first described and characterized, it represents a primitive immune system that protects bacteria from invading viruses.
Some clever biologists recognized that the CRISPR system could be used for genome editing. This means we have a powerful tool to correct genetic mistakes, to alter the properties of human cells, and fight cancer.
In 2015, Chinese scientists used CRISPR to edit the genome of a human embryo. This sent shockwaves around the scientific world, and now other Chinese scientists are altering human immune cells to enhance their cancer-fighting properties.
One approach alters a gene for a protein called programmed cell death protein 1. Scientists have used CRISPR to knock out the protein in immune cells. By doing so, cancer cells can't activate this protein and cause the immune cells to self-destruct. This allows immune cells to more effectively kill cancer cells.
This approach is being used to attack prostate, lung, and bladder cancers. Others are replacing T-cell receptors with ones that destroy leukemia cells.
Even though some fear CRISPR could be used to create customized super babies, it can become a powerful weapon against our most stubborn diseases.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Ryan Richards from the Colorado School of Mines. And you were talking about the Harbor process, which is mainly iron, as the catalyst, and then these automobile platinum catalysts. What is it that you're working on now? What's getting you excited about what you're trying to discover?
So at a high, high level, the planet that we live on has about 7.5 billion people. And if you look at it, about 2 billion of those people have a quality of life that we would consider acceptable in terms of access to clean water. And if you start to dig down on that, your quality of life is directly related to the gross domestic product of your country. That makes sense. The gross domestic product of your country depends on the amount of energy your country consumes. It takes a lot of energy to make something like an automobile or a computer chip or something like that. Your access to energy is directly related to catalytic processes. So how you're able to transform either natural resources into energy, or if we're going to do this in a sustainable manner, how we're going to be able to capture, harness, store, and move around energy from solar or other sustainable forms of energy. In a sort of nasty paradox that nature has played on us, the things that are best at these transformations are these elements that we don't have very much of. So platinum, for example, to get 1 ounce of platinum, as I mentioned earlier, they only have platinum mines in Russia and South Africa. They have to mine 10 tons of ore and refine that for 5 months to get 1 ounce of this platinum out. So to have a sustainable catalytic future, we need to be able to have earth-abundant systems that are able to do similar types of...
You know, I had a student recently who was talking about exactly what you're talking about, the platinum metals, and he presented a proposal where we would get them in space because the meteorites that are running around are the... are filled with them.
Yeah, so at Mines, we actually just launched the first space resources program in the country. And so this has been something. So one of our historical strengths has been in the geosciences. And I wasn't aware of this until I came to Mines, but NASA has a number of these probes floating around, and they're mining different asteroids in different places. And the control panels for those probes mining those are at our university and some of our geologists. So, yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, a geologist has to look and say, okay, that rock over there looks interesting. Let's take a sample from that. And we're going to need to do this technique to get a chunk of it. One of my colleagues, Angel Abud Madrid, gave a really great TED talk last year on exactly this, on using space resources and going out and tapping the universe.
So are you actively involved in that type of a project?
So I've just taken baby steps into this. So as you mentioned earlier in the show, I'm an inorganic chemist who makes metal and metal oxide catalysts, some metal carbides, things like that. And as it turns out, those are a lot of the native materials on the moon and Mars. And so what NASA is looking at doing is they want to make catalysts on the moon and on Mars so that we can make propellants and oxygen and water and ultimately all sorts of things on the moon and on Mars. You can't bring all of this stuff with you.
Using what's there
using
on Mars
native
or
ingredients,
the moon right now.
Right?
Right.
And so if you have an opportunity...
That's an ambitious goal.
Well, if you have an opportunity to watch Angel's TED talk, he likens it to when Europeans were discovering North America, right? They didn't bring all of the wood and all of their drinks and everything with them. They learned how to do agriculture, right, and how to use native materials on North America.
Is the moon and Mars, I don't know enough about the geology, but are the minerals there pretty much reminiscent of what we have here?
We can make mimics here. So a lot of it, what they want me to be looking at is iron titanate. So you have a mixture of titanium oxide and iron, and we're looking at different ways of manipulating that so that you can And then the native ingredients.
No, I remember working on exactly on the moon project.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea there for our listeners was, could we make enough minerals there? Are there enough minerals there so that we can make the energy and inhabit the place?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now what they're looking at doing is there's a lot of sort of what I call C1 products up there. So CO2, methane, things like that. And if we could convert those, probably using solar energy into propellants, that would be a great thing. So for a lot of space endeavors, you really burn the most propellant exiting the Earth's orbit. Then if you could refill on the moon, you could go really, really far.
Or decide I want to go home.
or decide you want to go home and take that back. So we're working with an interdisciplinary team with everything from computer scientists, robotics people, geologists, mining people, mechanical engineers, and then, of course, chemists and chemical engineers to try to devise ways to do this.
This sounds like Russ's dream, right? I mean, an interdisciplinary going all the way from theory to experiment and then
and
product.
And one of the things that we have done is really for cobalt molybdenum and nickel molybdenum, shown that really goes up the scale, because when you get this donation to molybdenum, it acts like rhenium.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that in many cases you can get the noble metal-like behavior if you get the right promoter and do the structure and the computing.
That's exactly right. And so there's been a lot of breakthroughs recently with machine learning, this materials genome initiative, things like that. So really trying to computationally look at different ways of arranging matter that we would then, so me as an inorganic chemist would take that challenge and try to make this thing that the computational people would tell us is great.
Talk a little bit about that genome concept.
So the materials genome concept is this idea that that we can use computational power. People all around the world are studying all sorts of materials, getting all sorts of information about the properties of materials, and then using them in different applications. And so the idea of the materials genome is you're going to be able to collect all of that data from all of these different things, and then it's really going to be mathematicians and computer scientists that are in trying to find the common linkages and process huge amounts
of
data.
I've always told my students that if you do the theory right, that saves you a lot of experimental time, because the theory says, don't do that, do that.
Yeah, and I mean, and just in terms of pure mass, the number of experiments you would have to do and the number of atoms you would need to use to go through this is just unrealistic. It's too impossible.
The issue there, of course, is that you've got a specific goal. This is a very goal-oriented way of thinking about research, as opposed to a more serendipitous approach that says, well, no one's really looked at what happens when you put these two together and shine a light on them, and, you know, there are certain possibilities. It's not that easy to go and do those sorts of theoretical experiments, it seems to me.
That's exactly right, but it's a lot of this materials genome is taking in a lot of those things that have happened serendipitously, and some things that are probably happening serendipitously that people just aren't observing, and connecting those dots.
But you can with a calculation. We do that too. Is do the band gap and talk about how the electrons are excited by photocatalysts.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, and so. I have a joint appointment at the National Renewable Energy Lab, and so there they have a large center, which is exactly that. So it's called the Center for Inverse Design. So the computational people are looking at band gaps and what sorts of materials will give you certain band gaps. For the listeners out there, band gap, really, if you tune this gap, it will allow you to harvest electrons from solar energy.
We've got about 5 minutes to go. I'd like to hear, what do you think is one of your most well-known or most useful discoveries? I read on your website that you just made a breakthrough and someone says it's a breakthrough, on understanding why lithium batteries just don't do a good job sometimes.
Yeah.
Is that, it's getting recognition. Talk to us about that a little.
Yeah. So one of the materials that we've worked a lot with over the years has been magnesium oxide. And we found a way to make magnesium oxide with a certain faceting, so a certain exposed surface that theoreticians had predicted would be a catalytic playground. It would be great for all of these things. And in looking at this, and we realized several of those things, and then to figure out how in the world this stuff really formed in our reaction, we decided to do some experiments with nickel oxide. And nickel oxide is interesting because geometrically, just as a gift from nature, it is geometrically identical to magnesium oxide. To the thousandth of an angstrom, it's the same size, all of these things. However, magnesium oxide is a very strong insulator, has a huge band gap. Nickel oxide is a semiconductor. So we did the same thing, same preparation for nickel oxide that we did with magnesium oxide, and we thought we would get the same type of material, and we didn't. We got this bizarre sheet material that has these holes, these cookie cutter sort of hexagonal holes in them. And just by luck, I had this great graduate student, Feng Lin, and we started doing some work with, we are neighbors with the National Renewable Energy Lab, and we started using these in electrochromics. So these smart windows that changed a degree of transparency based on changing the electrical current to them. Then it turns out the things that are really good in electrochromics are sometimes really good as electrolytes and lithium-ion batteries. And what happens is, for these metal oxides that are the electrolytes for lithium-ion batteries, as the lithium ions come in, the lattice has to expand to accommodate those. And so this limits how fast and how many lithium ions you can move in. That's how fast you can charge and discharge these things. But you get fracturing in these metal oxides if you do this too fast and too much. Because we have these bizarre hexagonal holes in this nickel oxide, you can watch this thing under an electron microscope, and it breathes sort of like a human lung mm-hmm. as the lithiation front comes in and out. And so it's sort of a new paradigm for introducing stability to these electrolytes.
I mean, that's absolutely beautiful, but it was from a serendipitous result. Your theoreticians didn't explain to you that this was going to be the structure of your...
Oh, no, we were trying to do something totally different.
Precisely.
So, but one of the things that I think I want to get in here is that now, as a geologist and so on, there's this new lithium compound that goes around, which they're saying is going to be used as a fuel. I think it's Li2O2 or something. And they say you can go from New York to San Francisco on 1 gallon of it. I've forgotten the name of it right now, but there's this new lithium fuel that is going to be big deal in all these cars.
Yeah, I mean, I know
this isn't fake news. This is. I mean, I've not heard of this.
No. You're responsible for fake news, not me.
Yeah, no, I mean, lithium and the sources of it and the different compounds of it is a fascinating area. And I'm not familiar with this Li2O2 that you were talking about. But
I'm not sure of the composition, but it has a funny name. It's in all the reports. I'll have to look it up for you.
Yeah, no, that'd be great.
Okay, well, we've got to leave it there.
Right.
But it's been, you know, a delight to have you come down to the studio and straight out of what you'd call your catalytic playground.
Yeah.
That's an expression that I won't forget. All right?
Okay.
It's delightful. So thank you very much, Ryan Richards from Colorado School of Mines, Russ Chianelli from UT El Paso, myself, Keith Pannell, and, of course, Lauren Tarasas, who puts this whole program together. And thank you, and we'll be back next week with another Science Studio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.